invite you to stop a moment and think. Who is the person in your life to whom you have the most responsibility? The first thing that came to your mind might have been your child, your partner. You might have thought of responsibility to an elderly parent. Or you might have said that the most responsibility you have is to the oppressed people whose lives you seek to support. And certainly most of us do have responsibilities to a variety of people. But I want to introduce you to an idea that might be somewhat radical to consider. That the person you have the most responsibility towards is yourself. Why? Because that is the person over whom you have the most influence. And your relationship with yourself, the responsibility you take for that, is foundational to all the other relationships in your life. Are you kinder to others than you are to yourself? If you're like most people in Western cultures, your answer is probably, yeah. Most of us treat ourselves internally in ways that we would never treat someone else. We blame and scold ourselves for mistakes. We frequently have judging thoughts about ourselves. And we're harsh with ourselves about things that we do or things that we don't do. For example, if a friend experienced the painful breakup of a relationship and came to you for support, would you tell them, well, frankly, I'm not surprised. You are ugly and stupid and crabby, and it's no wonder that person didn't want to be with you. Of course you wouldn't say that to your friend. But yet, how many times have you said something similar to yourself? In reality, I know I have. We would all probably be compassionate and kind and consoling to the friend. But frequently, we are not compassionate and kind to ourselves. And yet, a saying attributed to the Buddha is, you can search the whole world over and never find anyone more deserving of your love and affection than yourself. There's a story of how the Dalai Lama, who was of course rooted in this Buddhist wisdom, was appalled to see the lack of self-love and self-compassion that we North Americans typically display. He's reported to have said, "Why do you Americans hate yourself so much?" Well, it's rooted in our culture. Along with many thoughtful people, I believe that this lack of loving care for ourselves is a root of much human suffering, not only within ourselves, but in the ways we interact with those around us. So I think that this month, with our theme of love, it's important to talk about how we love ourselves. One of the significant aspects of self-love is called self-compassion. Dr. Kristen Neff, a professor at the University of Texas at Austin, is a pioneer researcher and teacher in the field of self-compassion, and she's written a number of books on the subject. She views self-compassion as a skill that we can practice and learn. And she says that it has three elements: mindfulness, common humanity, and self-kindness. Dr. Ness defines mindfulness as being aware of our own moment-to-moment experience in a clear and balanced manner, being open to the reality of the present moment without resistance or avoidance. Our own self-criticism can become so habitual that we don't even realize when we're doing it. Recognizing the thoughts and stories that arise in our minds gives us the opportunity to observe those thoughts and stories rather than being swept away by them. Dr. Neff goes on to talk about common humanity as recognizing that all humans are flawed works in progress who make mistakes and experience hardships. While this may seem obvious, so often we fall into the trap of thinking that things are supposed to go well all the time, and we blame ourselves when they don't. This makes us feel isolated and alone in our suffering. But when we remember that pain, whether it's physical pain, emotional pain, is part of the human experience and that everyone feels it, it can be transformed into a moment of sensing connection with others. And finally, in Dr. Neff's work, self-kindness is defined as offering ourselves warmth and unconditional acceptance, soothing and comfort, rather than berating ourselves when we fail or when we hurt. It's being as caring towards ourselves as we are towards our friends. Dr. Neff's research has gone on to show that self-compassion downregulates the fight, flight, freeze reaction that most of us are familiar with in our nervous systems. And thus it helps us to choose wiser actions in moments of distress. One common objection to the idea of self-compassion is that it will make us weak, make us lose our edge. We may think, well, how can we push ourselves to do better if we're not mentally cracking the whip, so to speak? People sometimes think that self-compassion will turn us self-indulgent and lazy. But that is a false narrative taught by our culture. Hundreds of research studies undertaken by Dr. Neff and her colleagues show that humans who are self-compassionate are not only happier and healthier, but also more inclined to real pro-social behavior and altruism, the kinds of values that those of us who are gathered here seek to promote. We can still motivate ourselves to change habits or do something different, but we do it the way good coaches do, via encouraging ourselves rather than criticizing ourselves. And also, self-compassion has a fierce side. We can think of the gentle side of self-compassion as a parent cradling and soothing their crying child. But the fierce side is associated with acting in the world to alleviate our own suffering and the suffering of others. It can look different depending upon the situation and the actions required, but it tends to involve protecting ourselves or providing for ourselves. Think of the energy of the mama bear, defending her cubs or hunting and fishing to provide for them. This fierce protective energy can also be used for ourselves. It's self-compassionate to stand up for ourselves, to protect ourselves, to emotionally nourish and provide for ourselves. It's self-compassionate to draw boundaries and to say no when needed. Sharon Salzberg, a well-known meditation teacher who was among those who first brought meditation to the United States, tells a story of events that happened when she was a young student in India, and some of you may be familiar with this story. She was traveling in an open rickshaw through Calcutta with a friend to get to their next teacher. The rickshaw driver decided to take them through a back alley as a shortcut to the train station because they were running late. And as they went through that alley, a man tried to pull Sharon out of the rickshaw. apparently to rob her or to harm her. Fortunately, her friend managed to pull her back in and they escaped unharmed. Sharon was very upset by this. And being a new student, she was especially concerned about what was the right way to react. After all, her whole philosophy was based on not harming anyone. So when they arrived at the teacher's place, she explained what had happened and asked, well, what should I have done? What would be a compassionate response? The wise teacher listened carefully and then said, well, my dear, summoning all the love in your heart, you should have grabbed your umbrella and whacked that man over his head as hard as you could. That's fierce self-compassion in action. I grew up with a parent whose mobility was compromised. My mother walked with a pronounced limp due to injuries from a serious car accident she'd been in when she was only 21 years old. She tried as best she could to hide her condition around other people, and by her words and actions, she communicated to me that to be disabled was something to be ashamed of. Admittedly, she is a product of her time, when any disability was viewed as something to be hidden. But she restricted many of her activities outside of the home and her work because she didn't want her limp to be seen by strangers. And as she became older and her mobility became even more difficult, and she needed canes, a walker, she restricted her activities even more. When I expressed shock upon learning that she and my stepdad no longer went out to their favorite Friday night fish fry, she said, I'm ashamed to be seen as such a cripple. Now, I certainly didn't think there was anything wrong with her going out in public as a visibly disabled person. But I found out that it affected the way I thought about myself. So when I got older and started to have mobility problems myself because I have damaged knees, I tried as hard as I could to cover up that I couldn't walk or stand as well as the average person. And of course, as a result of that, I experienced increased pain and suffering. I've internalized all that ableism, and it was only through the practice of self-compassion that in recent times I've been able to untangle that internal self-criticism, to let myself be seen as a disabled person that I am, and to advocate for my own needs. And that's the reason you've seen me openly sitting down during portions of the service today when people typically stand. It's self-compassion, both caring and fierce. One fascinating finding of modern human neuroscience has been the fact that human minds are permeable, that is, not totally separated from other minds, but open to their influence in ways that we usually don't consider and might even not consciously perceive. It's interesting to see how scientists have discovered through imaging of the brain in action what a lot of ancient wisdom has taught. We're not as separate as we think we are. Most of us in Western culture go about our day thinking of ourselves as self-contained, autonomous entities that end at our skin, that our thoughts and feelings and actions are completely our own. But on the contrary, human nature is collective rather than completely individual. If you've ever been to a large sporting event, a rock concert, a political rally, you've probably experienced that crackling flow of energy that suddenly merges you with the crowd, or you're moving and singing and chanting in unison. Sometimes you might even have experienced that in this place. Like a flock of birds or a school of fish that turns and moves in unison, humans too have a collective energy as our nervous systems influence each other. We have complex mirror networks in our brains that cause us to feel a version of what those around us are feeling. Have you ever walked into a room and even before you spoke or interacted with anyone, felt the vibe that's present? Whether it's friendly, excited, maybe anxious and fearful? That is your brain picking up subtle cues from the expressions and movements and maybe even the scents of other people at a level that's below your consciousness and causing your brain to mirror that feeling. We are highly social animals whose survival depends upon working together effectively. And evolution has wired our brains and bodies in this way to ensure our success. We are individual organisms, but we are also a collective organism. But what does all this neuroscience have to do with the importance of self-compassion? What it boils down to is that if you are being compassionate to yourself, other humans who are present will feel your compassion and mirror it in themselves. So cultivating compassion and love for yourself, you're passing those qualities on to others. Loving me is loving you. Being in a loving frame of mind towards ourselves encourages the same in those we come into contact with. So I invite you to look for opportunities to be good to your body, mind, and spirit. Remember that what we feel in ourselves impacts not only our ability to do things, but everybody around us as well. Our ability to show up effectively. And it's going to happen whether we want to or not. I want to acknowledge that self-care and self-compassion are not always easy, particularly for those of us who grew up being taught, either explicitly or implicitly, to put ourselves last and to put everyone else's needs first. Self-compassion is a practice like so many other things, and sometimes we will find it difficult. We can, however, always try to turn towards ourselves with compassion and non-judgment. Being mindful of our thoughts and emotions. Recognizing, yes, all humans have these kinds of experiences. And extending care and warmth to ourselves. For those of you who are interested in learning specific helpful self-compassion practices, I encourage you to check out Dr. Neff's website, self-compassion.org. The song we shared together a short time ago is, as many of you likely know, based on the Buddhist meditation called Metta, or loving kindness meditation. May I be filled with loving kindness. May I be well. May I be peaceful and at ease. May I be whole. And it's significant that both the meditation and the song begin with offering those wishes to ourselves, because that is the foundation of loving kindness. We establish loving kindness and compassion in ourselves first in order to be able to offer it to others and to the whole world. Or to put it another way, in the words of the fabulous RuPaul, if you can't love yourself, how the H are you gonna love somebody else? May we love ourselves as deeply as we love others. Thank you.